Morning, how are you?
I take it we're not on teleconference, but for the record, I'm Nancy Lucera, Commissioner of Administration, and I am with the Sharon Barton, who's our Director of Administrative Services. I believe that the members of the committee have been provided the summary document that I'm going to walk through this morning and just will help us track a little bit on things. I thought it would be helpful to give a snapshot of the Department of Administration. As you know, we have two primary functions. The first being core government services, that is that we provide the overhead functions for other state agencies. This includes personnel function, general services, finance, retirement and benefits, risk management, which is the insurance function for property and casualty in the state, and of course the computer services that are provided to all of the state agencies. The budget on that side of the shop is a maintenance budget. There are no increases associated with it except for the formula program in leasing. These are services that frankly go on regardless of how many other departments there are in support because of the computer chargeback, which was initiated during this past year. There is in fact some correlation to the amount of business that other departments do in the computer services area and the cost of that budget. On the other side of our shop is the services to the public. These are programs, that have come to the Department of Administration primarily because of the department's objectivity, I suppose is what you would say. Whenever there's a conflict of interest with other programs, it seems to end up in the Department of Administration. So on that side of the shop, we have the Pioneer Benefits, which include, of course, longevity bonus and the six Pioneer homes in the state, the Older Alaskans Commission, the Public Defender Agency, the Office of Public Advocacy, which was established as a stopgap for public defender conflicts, and the Public Offices Commission is also on that side of the shop. The public broadcasting system has been placed over in services for state agencies, not so much because it is a state agency function, but rather because of its rather complex technical aspects. So we've sort of grouped that over on the side that deals with communications issues. And this summary is on the next page. I'm going to walk you over to page 6, which are some pie charts that will just give you a snapshot of what the department looks like. You can see on page 6 that the services to state agencies in the general fund is approximately 1.79% of the overall state budget. I always think it's kind of interesting when we talk about general government. There is a perception that it is this huge amount. This really is general government. I mean, this is what turns the lights on and people go into work. These are sort of the core services that are going to go on regardless. Most of the other administrative costs that we associate with general government are programmatic. If the program goes away, those administrative costs go away. This piece is what it takes to keep government running on a day-to-day basis. That it does go up, and if you look at the other fund aspect, which includes the computer services, is the biggest piece of that, which puts us at 3.24%. On page 7, this just breaks down within our department where the funding goes. You can see clearly that the huge, huge piece of our budget goes to the social services component, which is the Pioneer Homes, and the longevity bonus. The general government component is primarily made up of leasing costs. Leasing and computer services. Education is public broadcasting and RATNET. I think that they're put into the education component because it's the closest thing that makes sense. The Administration of Justice, of course, is the Public Defenders and the Office of Public Advocacy, and the public protection aspect of it is the Public Offices Commission, which is the one regulatory disclosure system. Again, just the other chart below that shows total funds. Finally, is a breakdown as we look at our budget, which is services to state agencies and services to the public. Again, 75% of our budget is services to the public in one component or another. To give you a snapshot of this year versus last year, where our budget is going, we do have a bar graph, which you'll find on page 9. I'm just burning through these quickly so we can get to sort of some of the issues that are going to have to be dealt with this session. You can see going from left to right where the big chunks are. I mean, we've grouped these not by DRU or component, but rather by function, and that is the core government services, commissioner's office, admin services, personnel, finance, general services, are all either the same or slightly reduced. The leasing is increasing every year, mostly because of market conditions. Retirement and benefits, e-course, of course. Risk management, computer services, we are seeing some reduction in that area. RATNA, APOC, APDC. Again, straight across the board, I don't have to point out the details on this, but you can see on the far right-hand side where the biggest costs go, and that, of course, is to operating the 6 pioneer homes and the ever-increasing longevity bonus component, which increases about $5 million a year. I'd be happy to go down on page 11. We have just a quick snapshot of where we were last year, what we're proposing this year, and what some of the key changes are. Again, one more time, it is longevity bonus is the biggest chunk of the increase to this, and we're just making up the preponderance of the others. A bunch of the other variances are somewhat incidental. You know, their funding source changes, federal receipts, and that sort of thing. Mr. Chairman, would you let me walk down, sir, would you?
Excuse me, yes, I would, please.
Okay. Again, just going through on the variance side, the longevity bonus is going to be up this year, 4.685, which is about an annual issue. On the Pioneer Homes, there is a variance of 62.5, and that is a reimbursement from longevity bonus. The Pioneer, again, this is sort of an interagency issue where administrative costs for the Pioneer Homes are done by the longevity, or other way around. Functions for the longevity bonus are done by the central office, which is put in Pioneer Benefits, and it's a reimbursement from one program to another. Older Alaskans Commission, there is a reduction in approximately $300,000 in grants. However, we're going to be picking up some additional funds in the federal arena this year. And there will be some additional positions associated with this function through the Project Choice. As you know, or probably have read about, we are going to be coming in with a proposal to consolidate senior services throughout the state. Right now, senior services are provided by about 7 different divisions within state government. Our proposal is going to have 3 components. One will be to consolidate the elder abuse functions, elder services, protective services for seniors. Secondly is to enhance the assisted living component, and that reflects a trend toward keeping people as independent as they can be for as long as they can be without institutionalization. And this is an enhancement for community-based services for the senior community. The third piece is an organizational bill that will have to, because of the complexity of many of the seniors programs, we'll just shift these programs into one division on aging, which we would anticipate right now being in the Department of Administration. So one piece of this is the Project Choice. The Public Defender and the Office of Public Advocacy, we're asking for increases in their budgets. They are one of these programs that are caseload driven. They are a black hole. There's never enough money to be able to adequately fund them, frankly. But for years and years and years, every year they come in with a supplemental. And we think it's time to say, this is what it costs to run these programs. Let's give them the funding that they need to do it and then have them manage to those budgets, because I think we just exacerbate the problem when we intentionally underfund them. On Commissioner's Office, again, this is an interagency transfer to provide some support for the retirement benefits programs, which are a tremendous policy area we spend a lot of time on. Administrative services are neutral. Personnel EEO reflects the transfers in from the other agencies through the consolidation. We released an audit just last week on the personnel consolidation, which took place over the past 2 years, and in fact, there's a determination that about $1.1 million a year is being saved as a result of the personnel consolidation that's statewide. $400,000 of that is real money that is actually backed out of the budget. Some of the money, about $700,000, is basically we're freeing up resources that are being allocated for other functions within the departments now. And that audit is available if anyone would like a copy of it. Finance is a reduction from unrealized federal funds. Again, some of these are the budget intricacies on general services. We are anticipating additional program receipts from the surplus property area. They've done an exceptional job in being able to obtain and market surplus property from federal sources. Retirement and benefits. This is primarily a funding source in terms of the reduction in general funds. It is a piece that's contained in the omnibus bill. The overall increase is related to the E-Force. We have, I believe, three people retiring this year on the E-Course system, and that's budgeted on an annual basis, so our experience is up on that. Public Offices Commission level, with management, of course, is all IA receipts and is maintained at a maintenance level this year. Information services, this is related somewhat to chargeback federal funds components. RATNET is short funded. RATNET was short funded last year, and I can tell you that we're scrambling right now. This $200,000 was pulled out in the waiting days last session, and it has been short funded. $1.2 million, while we're is across the board, will be a reduction in service. We were hoping to be able to maintain that program this year at a lower level. But we're concerned that at this funding level, there will have to be some cutback in service next year associated with it. Public Broadcasting Commission represents approximately 5% reduction in those grants. We've been working closely with the commission to try to get an integrated and coordinated plan for the delivery of that service, and again, the lease component. So those are the primary differences, Mr. Chairman. On the following page 13, with your permission, what I'd like to do is run down some of these things that we think are the key issues that, policy issues that are going to have to be addressed this session.
Please proceed.
Thank you. The longevity bonus program. Again, it's a $5 million increase every year. As you know, the governor is proposing legislation to phase out this program over a three-year period. It's a very simple proposal, and that is that if you grandfather people who are currently receiving the funds, and it has a three-year step down when the program ends. We believe that for every year that goes by that we don't step up to this program, the pressure becomes greater and greater on the current recipients, that in fact it's going to become harder to protect and grandfather in the current recipients as the pressure on that program grows. The initial advisory vote was in 1986. I mean, it's 7 years later and we still have the program. It's $88 million, costing us $88 million more over that period of time. We have to do something. And while there have been a number of wonderful proposals that have been floated, and I'm not suggesting that our proposal is necessarily the best solution, but I think that it probably factors in the key pieces that have to be taken into account, and that is that we need to protect the people who are in the program, we need to get as much financial relief from it as soon as we possibly can, we need to be realistic and protect those people who have a reasonable expectation of doing their retirement planning around the longevity bonus. This plan is simple and it's understandable, and we certainly are looking forward to working with the committee as we consider other solutions. I don't think that we're dug in or entrenched. I think what we recognize is that we have to do something about it, and we're looking forward to working with the committee on that. Senior services consolidation, I've already mentioned that. There's been a lot of work done by the Department of Health and Social Services, Community and Regional Affairs, and Department of Administration on these programs. It will be a three-piece package of legislation, which will bring this, you know, the buzzwords are one-stop shopping. And that's basically what we're trying to do, is enhance the one-stop shopping, reduce the cost of administration of these programs, and community-based as much of these programs as possible so we can have direct access for the seniors. The residency requirement for Pioneer Home. As you know, the residency requirement was struck down this year. It was done in Superior Court, which means that it's not universal. Ironically, because we chose not to appeal the case, we have provided ourselves a little bit more latitude in time, the luxury of buying some time, in how we want to deal with this issue. Our recommendation is going to be to bring residency requirement in line with the other programs that are available with longevity bonus and permanent front, which is a year. I've heard others suggest 2 years. I don't think, you know, it's a practical matter, 1 year or 2 years. Either would be adequate. The second thing that we're proposing to do in a corrective piece of legislation is to protect the current waiting list. We think that that's going to be very important to protect the seniors and to the extent possible the original intent of that program. Obviously, this approach is more of a housekeeping issue than it is a huge policy issue. I mean, we are doing as little as we can do to protect the people who are in the homes and the waiting list. However, obviously, there's going to have to be a lot of discussion and debate about the ultimate direction for the Pioneer Homes. And again, I think this is an area that we need to have a lot of conversations. We've been talking with the residents of the homes as well as many of the seniors and have solicited their input. People are talking about these things, and I think that's real healthy and constructive as we start talking about the policy issue. Personnel consolidation, again, I've mentioned that. We have seen real savings associated with this. What we found in this process was really two things. By scratching the surface in the whole personnel area, we found that we have a system that has built up primarily as an enforcement system. I mean, it's an administrative, go by the book kind of approach to management. And in fact, I think that we have a workforce that is hungry for being developed, being motivated, being inspired, finding greater satisfaction from their work. The personnel system has looked to a top level of political appointees for their management direction. And while certainly it is appropriate to look to these people for policy direction, the fact is because of the nature of the turnover of this class of management, there's very little consistency. We have a system that has just sort of evolved. This is the great bureaucracy. I believe that management has a far greater responsibility and obligation to the workforce to provide them with sound management policies and practices. And this is something that we've been working on, part of the steering committee that was formed to look at this. And this is tying into the merit system. How can we make the merit system be something more than a rubber stamp, get everybody a raise every year, 99.9% of people get a raise and get a blow-off evaluation? That's not fair. The employees deserve more than that in terms of their career and their development. I think that our expectations have been too low, and I think that our rewards have certainly been high. Of course, the other issue in personnel is that we do have all of our collective bargaining agreements up this year. And we're currently in negotiations with several of those unions, and we'll be entering into others very soon. The consolidation of state building leasing activities. This is something that again, we've talked about for some time. There's an executive order number 87. Right now, the leasing function is in the Department of Administration. The public facilities management function is in the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. It just simply does not make sense. We have a leasing component that is subject to all of the vagaries of the procurement system. system, it doesn't work very well in the area of real estate in terms of how do you get the best deal, you know, the best quality for the best price. This executive order takes the first step, which is to transfer and consolidate, merge, if you will. Merger is a better word because this is not necessarily a reduction of service, but it is putting these functions under the same management. We're hoping that later on the legislature will consider a proposal to make some other accommodations to the real estate management area. The state right now manages or owns some 2,500 buildings. We have a huge leasing budget. We don't do a very good job of maintaining our facilities and our assets, our real assets. And we think there are probably some changes that could be made to that system, but that would be through a legislative proposal. This executive order is the first step to at least merge those two functions and look at them as an integrated piece. We also think this will go a long way to help us with ADA compliance issues because we'll have a consistent approach to all state facilities. RATNET, APBC, and telecommunications. Last year, there was a tremendous amount of discussion with regard to the delivery of broadcast services throughout Alaska, both RATNET and public broadcasting, and the other potential for telecommunications, including the Department of Education and the university. We've spent the past 6 months working with the Telecommunications Information Council, bringing that body back up to speed. They are very close to the final version of the statewide plan for telecommunications and for information services. What we found specifically with these three programs is that they have different customers and they're in different businesses. What can bring them together is a common delivery system. Right now, we have different customers, different businesses, and different delivery systems. The technology is very close. Many people have heard of the compressed video technology. We've been studying the role of the state and getting involved with that and what the potential is for being able to integrate these various broadcast services through that single technology. As a practical matter, we think that the time is a little premature, and we would see that next year we'll probably have a capital appropriation request to proceed in that area. And in the meantime, you know, I think that we just have to sort of step up and say, is RATNET a service that we're going to continue? We have it in our budget. We think, yes, it's not going to go away. Public broadcasting, again, we think is a service that is not going to go away. I had to make certain assumptions when we go into this. You know, it's very easy from time to time to say, oh, gee, what are we doing in this business? And after a great deal of soul searching, I came to the conclusion that we have to say the state will always be in the broadcast service business. I mean, the fact remains that 90% of the state is in the non-commercial area. And there is no commercial benefit derived from many of the areas that receive these services. So to think that the private sector is necessarily going to step in. RATNET actually is a very fine example of a private-public partnership in delivering the system. So, Mr. Chairman, with that, these are the areas that we see as being that either you will have proposals before you or that we think should be topics of conversation and public policy debate during this next session. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Senator Kelly.
I'll wait, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Leger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've got four questions, things that came up. One, you mentioned in the older Alaska Commission that there were an increase in positions. I see in the short form four new positions. Could you describe what those four new positions will do?
They are associated with the Project Choice consolidation. And I would be happy to send you over a detailed description of that program and what those four people will be doing. But it's mostly a transfer from the Health and Social Services.
Okay. Another thing that on the retirement and benefits component, could you explain what now is the relationship between what your department does in retirement and benefits versus what revenue does in administering the pension plans?
Yes, the short story is that we We administer the program, they manage the investments. They take the money and they invest it on behalf of retirement and benefits. The function in our department is the administration of the program, the record keeping, the payouts, the negotiation to provide the benefits from retirement.
I think I know. Next question. On the leases, there's about $1 million increase from last year, maybe $900,000. Is there anything in particular that you could point to that shows where the increase came from?
Absolutely. Short stories, it was intentionally short-counted last year. I mean, it was an arbitrary, I can tell you, it was an arbitrary at the end of session. It was, you know, let's see if we can save some money on this and we'll pull, you know, $1 million or $2 million out. And, you know, again, this is not a question. There'll be a supplemental this year for leases to make up for that. So what this does is it says, this is what it's going to cost. And it's a form of program. I mean, we have leases we're locked into. We know what the rates are. We know what it's going to cost us to provide this system. So this is full funding.
Okay, so just to follow up on that then, if there is not an increase in square footage being occupied by the state or prices, basically it's flat. I think I'll pass on my last question. Thanks. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Let's get back to leases for a second. Commissioner, what control does the legislature have of any of the executive branches continuing to lease new buildings? You know, we spent a lot of time and effort not bonding for the last decade so that our debt ratio would go down as oil revenues declined, which is in fact the case, and all of a sudden lease payments are going up. Do we have any control over this, or is this we're sitting in a free floor?
You know, the decision is obviously in the funding mechanism. We did have a lot of discussion last session with regard to the merits of buying buildings as opposed to leasing buildings. I can tell you that it's one of the reasons that you see the executive order before you on the consolidation of leasing with building management. What we found was it is extremely difficult to negotiate. We felt that there were certain buildings that might be worth buying for the state because we could achieve significant savings in these costs to own the buildings. Of course, you know, not to complicate matters, but ADA issues coming into this sort of complicate matters. But the short story is what we found in trying to negotiate on these buildings and look at these buildings is that because of the procurement process, it's very difficult to go out and handpick a building and say, this is the building we'd like to make an offer on. The system doesn't work very well in that area. I think that clearly the government has indicated on a number of occasions that we think that that many of the state's properties are shoddy. They're not very good quality. The leaseback arrangements that we've had with some buildings, from the DEC building, I think is a real good example. The plywood palaces that we have both in Anchorage and here in Juneau. And it's part of the procurement process that makes it really difficult for us to ensure quality. I'm not sure that I'm answering your question. Answer is that it's that what is the role of the legislature in this? It is going to be in the funding mechanism.
And what if we don't appropriate the money? Do you cancel the lease? Do each of your leases have a cancellation clause if the money is not appropriated by the legislature?
Constitutional provision, and you're right. Something has to occur if we don't provide. We cannot be committed from one legislature to another. There is something in the contract.
My question, Commissioner, was do you have a clause in each lease that says that this lease is cancelable if the money is not appropriated by the legislature?
I don't know.
Let's find that out, because then if you don't, we simply have no control. And executive branch, and certainly not this administration, but who knows, might be sitting there the next go-around, could, you know, lease the rest of the state and indebt the state over a long-term lease period, and there's no control in the legislature where control rests under the Constitution, as Senator Cordella indicated. So if you would check on that.
I'd be happy to do that. I guess, just so I can... be clear on what it is that we're looking for. Sometimes it helps me to understand what it is we're trying to fix. I mean, is it the cost of the police that's going to be the issue?
The long-term commitment of state fund by the executive branch without the concurrence of the legislature.
Most of those leases, it seems to me, are for relatively short time periods, aren't they? And they're not like 20-year leases, are they?
Oh, no, some are.
I know some are, but you've got literally hundreds of leases in that $30 million. And annually, I would suspect that, I don't know what percentage comes up, but a good percentage of them comes up for renewal every year, don't they?
Some do, yes. I mean, we have a tremendous network.
I mean, I've seen the list before from several years ago. It's a computer program that stands about this high with hundreds and hundreds of leases.
Sure. I mean, you're right. I mean, the short story is if you don't appropriate the money, we can't pay our leases, and we default on our, you know, if there's a contractual obligation, we default on it.
But at the same time, I think Senator Kelly's getting at, there is, and the point I would make is that there's hundreds of leases, and if you decide that if the legislature cut the budget by $5 million, $2 million, or whatever, you wouldn't have to default on leases. It might cause a heck of a lot of pain for the agencies that occupy those leases whose leases expire, but I suspect that there's enough annual renewals or enough leases coming for renewal that you would probably not have to technically default on anything. You just have, you know, the department of such and such sitting with no space, and you'd have to do something with all those bodies, and the program would not go on, and blah, blah, blah. But I suspect that is the real problem, not a technical default of a lease. But
well, but again, from my point of view, the real problem is continually increasing line item for lease space the legislature doesn't appear to have any real control over. If we don't appropriate money, how did you pay for all the leases that were short funded this year? How are you paying for those leases right now, if in fact the line item was short funded?
Well, you're saying if the supplemental doesn't go through to be able to do that?
Sure. What happened? Do we move?
Well, I guess we cross that bridge and we evict him, we default on our leases, and we get sued, and we probably end up paying more.
Well, that's my point. We get sued. So what do we gain? By attempting to control lease costs that didn't look through the legislature, the executive branch can put us in a position where, you know, we have to perform on their commitment, which essentially is debt service, which the financial markets look at as debt service. We've been stringently controlling our debt service in this state government for many years now, and the lease portion, which is in fact debt service, continues to increase, and that's a concern.
Well, we should get into this in subcommittee more fully, but
secondly, Commissioner, longevity bonus. Mm-hmm. Do you have your person here, your longevity person here?
Is that Dennis DeWitt? Person here.
Well, you're the head of longevity bonus program.
I don't think so, no.
Well, I happen to agree with the administration's proposal to phase out the longevity bonus program. I think a 3-year phase out is too long. I don't think the state's in a position to afford that, particularly as you look at revenue projections. So I'm not certain I'm going to support a 3-year phase-out, but I will certainly support a phase-out. When I was running for office this year, I received a list of the longevity bonus recipients in my East Anchorage district, and granted that my East Anchorage district is not totally representative of every district in the state of Alaska, but in my district, I couldn't find half of the people on the registered voter list. Half of them. Half of the people that supposedly are the hardest voting block of people in the world were not registered voters in my East Anchorage district that were receiving a check at that address not less than two months before. I was kind of wondering why. I mean, that's kind of an interesting question, right? I mean, either they're not citizens, either they don't live there and it's a blind drop, or they're headed south, or they vote somewhere else in some other state, perhaps. I mean, is there any kind of an audit mechanism that longevity bonus uses to make certain that those people are, in fact, alive and living where those checks are being sent to?
Yes. As a matter of fact, we initiated that 2 years ago, fairly stringent. I'm reluctant to call it fraud, but I guess that's what it is, fraud control. I mean, there was, and we have, in fact, taken people off the program because they, you know, check the consent to a child who sends it, you know, forwards it on to them in Arizona. I think that there's a lot of anecdotal evidence that there's abuse of the program. What we found is that it isn't, I mean, there's always 1 or 2% that are going to be a problem associated with this. But we have a difficult time trying to substantiate that it is substantive. You know, we've gone to the, gone over to the Department of Labor and asked them to do some research and analysis in terms of in-migration of seniors. I think we all can point to and say, yes, we know there's seniors that come up here because, frankly, a couple moving up to Alaska gets $8,000 a year. That's a good deal. Makes it worthwhile, and I think that we all can probably point to examples. But we don't see it as a real significant amount. We do have, as I said, we do have a fraud control. Yes, we do monitor. The checks can't be forwarded. They have to respond with a sign the paper upon receipt and send it in. It is a monthly process. It's not an automatic, you get a check every month. They actually, each of the recipients has to send in a verification form every month stating that, in fact, that they were residing in the state of Alaska before the fraud was committed.
Do you ever tell them, these people, at these addresses?
From time to time.
Okay. You know, as we go through and get into the longevity bonus program, we're all going to be seeing different projections for different types of approaches.
Sure.
Phase out at 1 year, no phase out, annuity, and all that. I'm going to ask for a projection from your office for a phasing it out, a total phase out of new entrants as of July 1, 1994. And if you might, you know, tell your folks that that's coming, it might expedite the process when I make that request.
Okay, just one point. It's going to be real important that as we do, and you're absolutely right, I think we all have a number of scenarios that we want to play out and cost them out. It's going to be real important that these are run on the same model because of the assumptions that are made. You know, if we start making different assumptions of demographics associated with this, or in some instances, the size of, you know, for the annuity programs, the size of the permanent fund dividends over the years, they are going to make real big differences in the way these numbers are run out. Right now, the model is held by legislative research, I think, that was used last year. As a matter of fact, we've been having some difficulty in having our scenarios run up against that model. Because what we want to do is be able to provide an apples-to-apples comparison.
Well, one last statement. You know, during the campaign, we contacted all of these longevity bonus recipients that we could find, or that were on the registered voter list in any case, about half of the 900. And almost all of them could care less about anybody new coming into the program. Their major concern is their check for as long as they live in Alaska. So I took, you know, my position was, I'll protect your right to get your check as long as you live in Alaska, but I'm real skeptical about newcomers. They voted for me, for the most part. So, you know, I don't believe it's politically courageous, you know, to do away with newcomers to that program as long as you're protecting those people that are currently receiving the check.
I would just make one comment, Senator, and that is that I got my first phone call the day before yesterday from a 61-year-old. Like I said, if I don't get mine, nobody gets
it. You're going to run into that.
Everybody.
And that's the cut we're going to have to make. Thank you.
Senator Sharp and then Senator Rieger.
Thank you as well, Mr. Chairman. Residency requirement for Pioneer Homes. I know that court decision was made last year, and currently I think they're working on 1 year. Is that what the court said?
The court just said the 15 years was
too long. Okay. Mm-hmm. So we're looking for a legislative fix, which currently it says 15 years in statute. I know 2 or 3 years ago, we tried 2 years on a longevity benefit and it didn't apply. These might be some different circumstances and maybe it's worth the delay and the court cost to try for a longer term than 1 year. I don't know, but what's the current waiting list going to be protected?
Our proposal will request that.
Lisa's, Senator Frank, the chairman, sort of just about scared me off of this question, but is there an itemized list on leases available down to, say, $250,000 a year and not get involved in it?
You can get the whole thing. Just pop it off the computer. It's
yeah.
Really,
sure.
Well, I, you know, it'd be interesting to see also the building, you know, the location, the owner, the leaser, and major partners or major stockholders, the square footage, by location and the cost by location, and agency who's occupying it, and the expiration date of the lease. I think that's some critical information for evaluation.
We'll be happy to do that.
Not that I want to give you a hand on micromanaging, but...
Bring the file cabinet.
Yeah, like the chairman says, punch the button and just print that out.
Yeah, I was just going to say that, but I think that, you know, I really appreciate the comments from you, and I think that what we, because I think we're all frustrated with it. You know, we went through this whole thing last session, as I say, with this buildings thing, to try to get a handle on it, because we understand that there's a frustration, we understand that it's a huge amount of money that frankly is going down a rat hole to some extent. And the conclusion that we came to in evaluating this is that we have structural problems in the way that these programs are administered, and we need to, you know, how do you fix something? Do you fix it as just saying, okay, we're not going to pay the money? Or do we fix it by saying, let's identify why it is that we can't manage these assets appropriately and try to fix the structural administration of it? And that's what we're heading for, is trying to get some market sensitivity and management of these assets in a professional, professionally managed scenario, to be able to work with the real estate market, which is a very sophisticated area, appropriately. I mean, we don't have people within the state government that can adequately appraise and assess properties. I mean, it's just, it's bizarre. So you'll be seeing more from us on that. But in the, as I say, I'm just trying to reinforce here that that we agree with these concerns, and we're hoping and looking for some suggestions on how to address this as well.
Okay, yeah, because the only one I'm familiar with is the latest addition down the hill here, and the annual cost and the escalators that we looked into when we, last year I think we amended a bill and put a limit on what the amount of the lease could be without legislative approval, annual lease, not total. Mm-hmm. And you know, I'm of the opinion that there's only two ways that you put pressure on an agency. Either don't give them a place to put the people, or you cut the wages for the people. So this is the other one end of the spectrum. And my only other comment is on the longevity bonus. So when you look at your recap sheet here on changes in dollars, mm-hmm. And it's obvious to anyone where the major dollars are going for the increase, and I stand ready to help out on solving the problem on the longevity bonus. I've talked to a lot of seniors. They realize that it's a target, and a lot of their basic needs are looking at that as a target to relieve the pressure on them, so we've got to do something.
One thing that I might mention, Senator, is that you know, there were a number of proposals floated last year that we've impacted seniors. And you know, during that period of time that we all remember, where my gosh, we're looking at $200 million hole, and what are we going to do? what you'll see is that our budget reflects a commitment to say we need to maintain stability in those services. We want to enhance delivery of community-based services through a simple consolidation. There were some things in the paper. There was an error made that we corrected it, and that is that the whole harmless provision, you know, you don't need to be kept and held in place. Those people who are the most dependent on help not suffer through this. I think that to do too many things at one time is irresponsible. The proposal that we're coming in with is longevity bonus, and we feel strongly that all of the senior programs should either be held constant or be.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Senator Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one last follow-up question on the longevity bonus. Are you aware of any studies that show the cross-section of the total residency of recipients of the longevity bonus?
Can you do that?
No, duration of residency in Alaska.
We have recent information on that. We don't have, this may be a lie. This may be a little bit of a lie, but I think we've got it from 86 forward. But we don't have anything before that because we didn't have a computer system that captured that information. We know, what we know now, I mean, for example, I can tell you now that, 25% of the people coming on the program annually now have been in the state for less than 5 years. That kind of information?
Yeah, that, I would appreciate having that.
I can give you all kinds of stuff like that on recent numbers. I can't go back to straight.
I'd appreciate having that kind of information.
Happy to do it.
And back to the pension question. You know, I glanced briefly at the reports, and reason for my earlier question, I was trying to figure out if this is on your watch over in revenues where this concern gets addressed. But I noticed that in our pension systems, the state comes out with reports that shows that the systems are somewhere between 90 and 100% funded. I mean, one of them might be down around 80 or 87% now, but on a $5 or $6 billion program, even that means we're maybe $500 million behind the eight ball in what the future obligation is. But the thing that also caught my eye on that is that several years ago, the general level of interest rates was much higher than it is today. And at that time, the pension funds were assuming that they could earn something in the neighborhood of 9% a year between now and when they started having to pay these obligations. Since then, interest rates have dropped tremendously. But the assumption about how much the assumption the funds are making about how much they're going to be able to earn has hardly changed at all. I think it's dropped. My impression is it's going to drop maybe a quarter or a half, 8%. And I wonder if there's an optimism built into how much the state's going to earn that is dramatically understating the liability hanging out there on those pension funds. And I don't know if that's something the Department of Administration does, making these assumptions, or if it's revenue. Do you have any comments on that?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. Senator Rieger, the short story is we pay big bucks to actuaries who provide us with that information. I mean, it's not something that we do internally. There are assumptions that are obviously are made. The funding ratios right now are sound. You know, sometimes we think, well, anything less than 100% makes us vulnerable. It has been on a downward trend, as you say, because I think partially because of the earnings associated with the declining interest rates lately. And as a matter of fact, for the past several years, during this administration, we have not granted what they call an ad hoc post-retirement pension adjustment. There's an automatic kicker that comes in, but the commissioner of the administration is empowered to give an ad hoc increase, and we've chosen not to do so because we have been somewhat concerned about the trends in the funding ratio. We do contract that. I'd be happy to send you the actuarial data and the assumptions upon which those funding ratios are made.
I don't want to take a lot of time, but does the actuary make the earnings assumption or only crank out the likely liability based on an earnings assumption that the state gives to the actuary?
I don't know, but I'll ask. And I would certainly presume that those earnings assumptions would be developed by the Department of Revenue. I mean, they invest the funds and they would tell us about what we can hope to get. But as a practical matter, 8% is not that optimistic because even though, it's relatively diversified for that size of a fund, it's a little high, but...
Yeah, and that's another issue which we should debate on whether the composition of the portfolio was right. I'm sure that is for revenue. But I did notice, just as a comment, that last year I remember reading some articles that the school districts were faced with a dramatic increase in the pension contribution requirement. I don't remember the numbers, but I'm sure the commissioner remembers that it was something like a 5% payroll deduction increase. And that was determined, I assume, objectively, as the need for an increase in the amount of money needed to be contributed to keep the pension plan whole. And there were financial problems generated as a result. And that contribution rate was unilaterally just rolled back. And I thought that was a real alarming precedent to reduce the amount of a pension contribution because of the financial pressures that it created on either the state or local government. And that, you know, I just kind of an alarm bell went off when I saw that. And I think that that ties in, I think, with your observation that the funding ratios on these pension plans are on a downward trend. So it's just a concern I have. Thank you.
I share.
Go ahead.
I share that concern, and obviously this is, all this is on the assumptions you do, how long do you pull it out, you know?
Yeah.
You make assumptions over 25 years, and all of a sudden, your base goes down.
Senator Pierce.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Quick. Did you?
Excuse me.
Go ahead. Excuse me. Sorry.
Okay. Commissioner, back to the leasing activities and Executive Order 87. Is there discussion within the administration about tackling the procurement code problem on real estate or leasing?
The short story is yes. The problem isn't so much the procurement code as much as it is that it doesn't work very well for real estate. As you know, I think that you can't ignore the politics. I can tell you that since I've been at the Department of Administration, lobbyists do not line up at my door for practically anything save real estate. I mean, it was a real interesting eye-opener to me. I can see why so many controls are put into place that restrict the latitude to be able to deal with the market. I mean, this is big bucks, it's big money, it's big business. And there have been, as we all know, some rather unfortunate political fallout as a result of leases in real estate issues. And consequently, this barrier has been built up that sort of ties our hands in being able to manage this effectively. So we identified really two things. One is that we need to have our real estate assets managed outside the system, and the proposal that you're going to be see coming, floating up past you, is the creation of a real estate management authority type concept, which is that we have people who are real estate experts who can do two things. Number one is that they can manage our assets better, and secondly, they can provide for long-term deferred maintenance commitment, because as Senator Kelly so pointedly showed us, I mean, it's a year-to-year kind of thing. You know, we all know that sometimes we rob the deferred maintenance fund to make other ends meet, and all of a sudden the crack in the ceiling becomes a hole. We think that the funding mechanism is going to be real important, and then secondly, being able to deal with the inconsistencies of a very competitive market. So that's a proposal that we're going to be coming up with, and my understanding is that it's been drafted and that we'll be introduced the dot product.
I know the executive order is
going to be in discussion. The legislation that will deal with the procurement issues will be voted up lately, and DOT probably will need agency on that, but we absolutely support it.
Okay.
Senator Tula.
You want to be careful, this series, and I'll rather quickly go through them. You want to be careful that you don't fall in the asset traps or with setting up separate agencies. They get out of hand, they do their own lobbying, and while you cure a big problem, you create yet another. So do what you can when you boilerplate something to make sure that it's still publicly responsible, publicly responds to some decent mechanism, doesn't set up an entity of its own, becomes an empire all its own, and keeps on and on. The Robert Moses problem you're going to create, be very, very careful. The actuarial soundness has been a concern of ours for a number of years at finance, probably back to the time you were here previously. of these funds. I just want to say that every time you put in RIPs and so on, this question keeps coming up. Are you fully covering it? And each time the proponents raise a great deal of hell and show that the funds are actually sound under the present conditions, et cetera. But I think that's a very good question, one that I think you make a real contribution to some of the rigor. I do want to quickly go over a couple other things. When you go into negotiations, I see that you continuously erode some of the medical provisions and so on. But I want you to remember, and unfortunately I have to say this, including the legislature, that our salaries don't go up, our programs don't go up. And while you're negotiating the salary increases for others, you remove some of the benefits. Our benefits go down, our salaries don't go up. I think the whole legislature ought to be aware of that. Some third party is doing that. Perhaps we don't deserve anything, shouldn't have anything. That's yet a decision to be made depending on the legislature administration. But the point is, they affect you continuously when they erode benefits. And the only benefit I ever thought I had was the medical one. And that's otherwise I subsidize continuously my service. That's my disease, my problem, but it happens to be a fact. And I think it ought to be mentioned at least, and I can mention it. Have you checked in other states? If you haven't, I would advise, and I'm doing that, have been doing that, check in other states and how they maintain benefits for varying citizens on the basis of residents, long-time residents. Arizona, of course, the pioneers you've gone over and over, I'm sure, but other states have varying benefits that go fit the more than 1 year residency in order to get. Maybe there's something in the word structure, one of those laws that would allow us, and I see it to you here because the pioneers thing, would allow us to restructure an act that would allow us at that time to extend the time from 1 to 2 or maybe more. Maybe we just haven't written the law right. Maybe it's just that nobody's attacked their particular benefits yet, and the sweeping decisions covering the state of Alaska haven't affected the other states. But they do have provisions that provide for 25, 15, 30 years in some areas, I'm told. It's kind of more rumor than fact to me right now. But I think we ought to restructure the law if we can. If there's anything out there, we ought to look at if we rewrite a law on any of these subjects. I do want you to go to page 7 because my opinion that you are so very confident, perhaps very cold-blooded, I don't know, but so very confident, right, that I wish that I had a job for you. On the other hand, looking on page 7, you missed something here on the top. When you go to social services, the designation for the programs of pioneers, that's fine if you wish to designate it that way. I know what you're doing, but if you do that, you also should go cross general government out, just go bloated bureaucracy as a designation. So that we get it all into context. One final statement, and that's on leasing. Capital move was one of the reasons for this all occurring, a whole lot of things, but we used to provide for both leasing and the legislature did, and construction through something called just a concurrent resolution. The Hammond administration took extreme exception to us not passing legislation on which to build. All we had to do was pass a resolution, and this was a horrendous, horrendous problem that's all we had to do. We just created a problem. So they wiped out that process and went into flat-out leasing, direct leasing with no concurrence of the legislature whatsoever, none. And essentially, these are long-term leases. Now, the theory of our Constitution says that you can't encumber one legislature with another. But I strongly suspect contract provisions of the U.S. Constitution, commerce clauses and so on, say that a contract will fly in the face of a state law and we're stuck. And damn it, they've been legislating and creating fiscal problems for us on a continuous basis. I mean, I hear $4 a square foot stuff in June. Laboratory, albeit. But still, we suffer from the idea that it's communism or socialism or something every so often. Those people that want to lease buildings at profit sometimes love to shove that out too. Of course, don't own buildings. But as a matter of fact, generally speaking, in the populated areas, except for short term, in the populated areas, the state should own its own buildings. And we shouldn't have these second and third class buildings that, as a matter of fact, one of them in Anchorage, we took people out for a long period of time because there's a mold or something affecting your breathing and lungs, people, and everything else. You're with a big, long suit. Well, I'll quit it just to say that it's incumbent, I think, upon the legislature, Senator Kelly, and you and I've been here, to change that. I think it takes legal law change. We should go over that whole thing with the Finance Committee. Would do a lot for the state that says, as of this time, certain programs are going to be followed, a whole new way of arriving at leases and arriving at construction with it and building the necessary building that comes on board. We just need to change the whole damn thing. I say that in front of the commissioner more than statements than questions, but I just want to pick up those pieces. Thank you very much.
Senator Kelly.
No. Senator Kelly mentioned it.
Okay. Are there any other questions? Questions from other...
Well, one more. Commissioner, Real Estate Management Authority, marvelous. Sounds like a good idea. Now, where are the positions currently in government that are doing these kinds of things that you're going to transfer to this new authority so we don't have to establish new positions?
Some are within the Department of Administration and some are within the Department of Transportation.
Yeah. Okay, so it's a direct wash. There will be no new positions added on this new Real Estate Management Authority.
I don't know if that would be your statement. I think that what we identified, I would say that we're going to be, the proposal will be some different positions that we have. I think that there are areas that we really don't have the kind of expertise that we probably should have to manage the size of portfolio.
They don't have to be experts. Somebody out there has been doing it. If they're not experts, just let them go down the road and let's try to maintain the same position level.
Are there other questions? Okay, thank you very much. Let's take a short recess. We'll start then with Fish and Game, and we'll postpone CNRA until next Wednesday due to the time. Did you get a hold of CNRA?
Yeah.
Let's bring the committee back to order.
Sure.
For those of you that didn't hear before we recessed there, we'll hold CNRA to next Wednesday. We have an empty day on next Wednesday so that we don't run into too much time constraint. And then we'll go ahead and proceed with Fish and Game. Commissioner, would you like to join us?
Mr. Chairman,
Senator.
I'd just like to say that I, for one, appreciate the fact that the Chairman is allowing the full range of questions now, because somehow when they occur, even though it's with the general introduction, I know that's what takes the time, but somehow when they occur then, they may never come back up again when we're all at the table.
Right. Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Commissioner.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. It's a pleasure to be here. For the information of those that perhaps haven't met some of the headquarters staffing, I'd like to introduce a number of my staff that are here this morning.
Sure.
Unfortunately, the first person I'm going to introduce isn't here. It's Chuck Meacham. Chuck is the deputy commissioner, and he's currently involved in the U.S.-Canada salmon treaty negotiations in Vancouver, and from all indications, going is very tough down there at the present time. So he's not with us today. Ron Somerville, who I'm sure most of you know or have known for some time, is here. Looks like a deputy. Aaron Bruce, the legislative liaison, who I'm sure has worked with a number of you here. And this Lynn Wallen, the chief of the public information section. Larry Jones, the director of administration. Bob Clasby, the acting director of the Division of Commercial Fisheries. Jeff Keenings, the director of the Bread Division. Norval Netsch, the director of Sportfish. We've got Wayne Reglin, he's the deputy director of the game, the Wildlife Conservation Division here. Dave Kelly also is currently tied up with the Board of Game in Anchorage, who is waiting to do some rather weighty issues Fish and Wildlife Field as well. I believe Laird Jones, who's the director of the Division of Boards, is here. Frank Rue, director of the Division of Habitat, and Rob Bosworth, the director of the Division of Subsistence. And it just came out of a House Resources Overview Committee, and I neglected to introduce a gentleman that I will catch this time, Mr. Frank Coleman, one of the commissioners from the Energy Commission, as part of this budget request as well. Mr. Coleman is here, and we will introduce him this time before I get two-thirds through the presentation. Mr. Chairman, just very briefly touch on some of the social and economic aspects of fish and game. I think that it's no secret to anyone the importance of fish and game to the residents of the state of Alaska. Certainly the commercial fisheries are a significant contributor. Excess of values in the range of $1.2 to $1.3 billion just for the key species of salmon, groundfish, herring, halibut, and shellfish. In addition to this, of course, we've got virtually thousands of Alaskans that are fish and wildlife plays a part in what we call the subsistence economy. Within that economy, we estimate something in the neighborhood of 40 to 45 million pounds of fish and wildlife resources find their way onto Alaskan tables over the course of the year. Recreational utilization of resources includes wildlife watching, certainly photography, trapping, or sport fishing, and hunting. And these industries are all keys. In the case of the sport fishing operations, we were licensed in 1992, about 386,000 people to sport fish in the state of Alaska. Sport hunting and trapping, we licensed about 218,000 people to participate in those activities. Altogether, they play an important role in the economy of the state of Alaska. I might add that certainly some of the non-consumptive uses, such as the photography and the animal watching and so forth, is a rapidly growing arena for the economy. A lot of the background material, Mr. Chairman, has been presented to the committee in the blue book here, and so we'll move quickly through some of these in terms of the missions and the priorities. I know your time is short. The missions and the goals, those are presented there on this. Generally, I'd like to say that the missions and the goals of the department are to manage, protect, and extend the fish and wildlife resources for the benefit of the residents of Alaska, as challenged by the statute. And moving on to some of the areas of major emphasis within the department, the budget that we're putting forth this year. Of course, one of the key areas is resource assessment and the allocation and protection of resources. That's the primary area of responsibility for the department. The budget that we put forth this year is a budget that really returns the function to the department to these key basic responsibilities of the department. We're looking, of course, at continuing efficiency within the department, and there we're looking at streamlining of our operations and our personnel. The people, the individual divisions within the department are operating personnel caps as far as pay grades are concerned. We make every effort in this particular arena to assess when a vacancy occurs. Do we in fact need that pay grade, or can we in fact move to a lower pay grade as far as accomplishing the job? We're constantly looking at that type of activity to improve efficiency. One of the arenas, which I'm sure you're going to be interested in, is some of the combining of the divisions that we're focusing on. And one of these we've accomplished internally was the combination of the oil spill division and the habitat division. That was accomplished because of the changing role of the oil spill activities of the department following settlement of the spill suit. We moved from a damage assessment mode of operating to one of restoring the damaged resources on this, and as a result, a lot of the activity was going to be habitat oriented, we felt, and as a result, we combined the two. We now have a single director and two directors, and continuing them in the restoration mode with the oil spill operations. We're also in the process now of developing a plan for the combination of the Fred Division and the Commercial Fisheries Division into a single fisheries operation. I think I told you last year that I was considering the combination of all three fisheries operations. My decision was to not include the Sport Fish Division in because of the separate funding sources and the concern that was expressed on basically both sides of the fence. The sport fishermen, the sport fishing community was not really favorable to the idea of combining it. The two divisions, the three divisions on this, and neither was the commercial groups particularly interested in seeing that occur. So I made the decision to not combine sport fish with the other two. We will proceed, or we are proceeding, with the combination of the Fred and Commercial Fisheries Division at the present time. And that executive order, I believe, is before the legislature at the present time. So, I want to assure those of you that may be concerned about this that the basic functions of the Fred Division outside of the management of the facilities themselves will in fact continue. We're not planning to move away from the support, for instance, for the private sector, the technological support for the private nonprofits, in the form of disease and genetics work and this type of thing. Those functions will continue within the Fred Division. We're talking about the management functions specifically for the major facilities within the state. And so it's a situation in which the Fred Division is being redirected. We're planning to move our focus on the hatchery operations, primarily into the interior and the northern parts of the state. These were areas in the state that did not benefit significantly from the push in the 60s and the 70s for hatchery operations. We have two facilities up there, one Clear and one Sacsiliac, in the Cotterview area, that will continue to be operated by the state in the development of technology for rearing hatchery technology in the more northern defiance. The Fred Division is also being reinvested, I believe, as I told you last year, into the mariculture area. Great potential growth. As we've seen pollution problems and so forth in the lower 48, the industry is moving north because we have the clean water to in fact offer as far as the mariculture industry is concerned. It's a small industry at the present time, primarily based in southeastern Yakutat, Prince William Sound, and Cook Inlet, but it has the potential for expanding throughout the Gulf area, and offers a great amount of opportunity for some of the smaller communities and so forth to get into agriculture business. We have done a fair amount of reprioritizing of programs. I've touched on some of these, the agriculture thing that we talked about. We're looking at reprioritizing some of our efforts that are ongoing in the salmon field, directly into cobalt management, a species very much in demand in both the commercial as well as the recreational fishery. There's a constant demand for better management, closer management, better definition of allocation issues, and we're working on genetics as related to not only the hatchery programs. We're also proceeding with development of technology and genetics for stock ID work on some of the more controversial fisheries. I'd mentioned the northern fisheries. We're seeing some of the same characteristics of the runs and the stocks in the Yukon and the Kuskokwim and some of the other areas that we saw in the Gulf when we began to build a program to, in fact, enhance and rehabilitate. And I mentioned that that's one of the areas that the preservation is now being redirected into as part of their responsibilities. We've continued and to look at economic diversification, revenue enhancement. Some of the projects that I've mentioned to you previously, but a recap here on this, we are looking at the hatchery program on St. George. An experimental facility here at the present time. We're looking we're seeing development in the herring pound fishery in southeastern sea cucumbers, the Atka salmon fishery, the combination of the department and the entry commission getting together and solving a long-standing problem out there. And we've got a new pink salmon fishery that was fished for the first time in many years in the Atka area. Last summer. mentioned the Yukon Initiative. My department was one of the players, Community and Regional Affairs, Commerce and Economic Development, and the Community Development Course. And that program, which involves about 150,000 metric tons of pollock, which are divided into various programs by developed by the communities bordering on the Bering Sea, was worth about $20 million in the month of December. And that is an ongoing program for the next 2 years. It's an area that we're going to have to monitor very closely in terms of success. The feds are not necessarily that enamored with the program, but it's a great opportunity for the state and the people of the state to, in fact, have a funding source for development of fisheries infrastructure within those communities. An additional area that we're looking at very hard is the in-season management of the sport fisheries. We're seeing tremendous growth in the recreational fisheries on a statewide basis. No longer a case of waiting, developing a management plan, and waiting for a year to obtain data. Recreational fisheries are in many areas are at a level where we have to have now in-season management of recreational fisheries and protecting the stocks. We continue to emphasize, of course, user pay type programs, and the utilization of funds where the user is paying for programs to support those. I point to the King Salmon Tag that was developed this last year. That, along with the license fees, I believe, generate about $2.7 million that will be, in fact, directed into recreational fisheries programs. King Salmon stamp money, of course, will be money that will be going directly into better management and enhancement of king salmon stocks on a statewide basis. As I mentioned before, the technology support for the private sector with the combination of the Fred Division will be continuing, and as well as need for, we're looking for some help in the development of a seed stock source for the mariculture industry. Say the industry is moving out of the lower 48 because of water degradation problems and moving to this part of the country. Due to our cold waters, we don't have a significant reproduction capability with the shellfish stocks that are in use. And as a result, we need to develop that because we're losing access to seed stocks as well in the I'm quite concerned, of course, about maintaining state jurisdiction. We continue in the litigation of challenges to the federal government, the extension of federal authority into our navigable waters. We're active in the Pacific Salmon Commission, which I mentioned earlier, which is the administrative body of the U.S.-Canada Salmon Treaty. The annexes of that particular treaty cover the conduct of major fisheries, basically all the way from southeastern Alaska to the Columbia River. And that treaty drives a lot of the management policy here in the southeastern area. You probably heard a little bit about it. Certainly federal legislation is a key area that we'll be deeply involved in over the next 12 to 18 months. Glacier Bay, where the Park Service is attempting to close out subsistence as well as commercial fisheries. We were unsuccessful in getting a bill through Congress this last year, but we were deeply involved in support of the private organizations, the fishermen's groups and the subsistence groups that were active in that legislation. We expect that legislation to be back before Congress this year. The challenge there, of course, is the phasing out of a major commercial fishery. The area involved ranges from the Nell sector down through the Icy Straits area here. It's the heart of the major troll fishery here in southeastern Alaska that supports the economy of many of the communities here in southeastern Alaska, as well as the subsistence utilization by many of the communities as well. Other federal legislation which is going to have us involved here over the next 12 to 18 months includes the reauthorization of the Magnuson Act, the Endangered Species Act, and the Marine Mammal Protection Act, all of which will have definite effects upon the management of the state's fish and wildlife resources. Additionally, we anticipate that we'll see new congressional legislation on the issue of biodiversity. From a financial perspective, of course, the department operates on general fund dollars, federal dollars, and special funds from other sources. Present time, we've seen fairly significant decreases in the general fund portion of the department budget. Between 1985 and 1994, looking at about a 14% decrease in actual dollars. That's substantially higher if you include the inflation during that period of time. We're looking at a decrease this year between 93 and 94 of about 5.6%. And the reason I raised the issue of general fund on this is that this year we will have less than half of the department's budget is in fact general fund dollars. That's the funds that we have the most flexibility with. That's the funds that when we have a problem in the field, in season, and there have been very few seasons when we haven't had some kind of difficulty somewhere, some issues that took special attention, those are the funds that we have to turn to. At the present time, we're losing the flexibility to, in fact, deal with in-season type programs because of the reduction in the general funds. Major impacts of the 94 budget indicated we're retreating primarily to the functions of the department, the basic management and research functions on this. The hatchery facilities received the bulk of the attention this year in terms of cost reductions. And generally what we're looking at is the closure or transfer of four hatcheries, Crooked Creek, Big Lake, Tawak, and Deer Mountain Hatchery. Crooked Creek, of course, on the Kenai, Big Lake is in the Susitna. Tawak is next to the community of Tawak and Prince of Wales and Deer Mountain Hatchery in the Ketchikan area. We're also looking at the full transfer to private sector. No program received programs at Toy, Filler Creek, and Gulf Canada. These are facilities that are currently operated by the private sector. And we supply the staffing for these facilities. They pay all of the bills. So in that particular case, it's just a wash in terms of the dollars. We feel, however, that the private sector look at these programs and perhaps operate them more efficiently and less costly than the state, although the relationship between the department and the operators of these particular facilities has been very good, so we're not parting as enemies in this particular case. It's been a good partnership. We're looking at transferring three facilities from the Fred Division to the Sport Fish Division. This is the Fort Richardson, Elmendorf, and Broodstock Development Center. So these are three facilities that are key to the Sport Fish program statewide. We'll continue to operate those in the budget. That would leave us with basically four facilities within the Fred Division. Snedisham, South Juneau, Crystal Lake at Petersburg, Sikasuliak, across the area, and the Clear facility on the upper Yukon. The Snedisham facility is currently in the process of being rolled over to a facility in which we could have a cost recovery element, and that facility we would hope to be in a position to transfer to the private sector within the next few years. We're not at that point yet, but we would hope that we could within the next few years. Crystal Lake is a facility that's producing a fairly substantial number of fish as some of the losses that occurred under the U.S.-Canada salmon negotiations, under the U.S.-Canada salmon treaty. Part of the treaty arrangements was the transfer of a fairly significant amount of federal dollars to the state for enhancement purposes as replacement of losses under the treaty. Crystal Lake is one of those facilities that contributes substantially to the troll fishery and the recreational fishery, and we have a capital budget for upgrading the water supply there and the continued operation of that. Sikasuliak and Clear, of course, is part of the Northern Technology Yukon program, which I had outlined earlier. Additionally, we've got crab pot identification program that is essential. We operate the shellfish fisheries in the Bering Sea under a framework plan developed by the North Pacific Council. Part of that the shellfish fisheries are showing tremendous growth as a result of the overcapitalization that's occurred in the groundfish operations up there, the shortening of the seasons for those groundfish operations, and the fact that the large factory trawlers and the larger vessels that are in fact participating in the groundfish operation now are entering the shellfish fisheries of the Bering Sea. Part of the board's efforts here is to develop a